Hear the word of the Lord now from 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 through 22. You can follow along in your program. I'll be reading in English, but you can also follow along in Spanish. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 through 22. Finally, all of you, have unity of spirit, sympathy, love for one another, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or abuse for abuse, but on the contrary, repay with a blessing. It is for this that you were called, that you might inherit a blessing. For those who desire life and desire to see good days, let them keep their tongues from evil and their lips from speaking deceit. Let them turn away from evil and do good. Let them seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. His ears are open to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Now, who will harm you if you are eager to do what is good? But even if you do suffer for doing what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear what they fear, and do not be intimidated. But in your hearts, sanctify Christ as Lord. Always be ready to make your defense to anyone who demands from you an accounting for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and reverence. Keep your conscience clear, so that when you are maligned, those who abuse you for your good conduct in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if suffering should be God's will, than to suffer for doing evil. For Christ also suffered for sins, once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, in order to bring you to God. He was put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he also went and made a proclamation to the spirits in prison, who in former times did not obey when God waited patiently in the days of Noah during the building of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were saved through water. And baptism, which this prefigured, now saves you. Not as a removal of dirt from the body, but as an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, with angels, authorities, and powers made subject to him. La palabra del Señor. Thanks be to God. Good morning. It's good to be with you here at Calvin University, here at this symposium. Thankful for this opportunity. Thankful for the opportunity as well to look at God's Word together with you. Has anyone noticed that our world is in a hot mess right now? We have wildfires and earthquakes. We have scandals in the news, trials over college admissions scandals, up-to-the-minute updates on impeachment hearings. We have celebrity meltdowns and celebrity controversies, and don't even get me started on Harry and Meghan. We have battles at the border and battles in social media and battles in government and battles in communities, and that's just January. Seems like the world's in a hot mess, doesn't it? A week ago today, I was in Honduras visiting my family. My father comes from La Ceiba, which is there on the coast, and we were in Honduras celebrating my tia's 90th birthday. Tia means aunt. We had an opportunity to go my father and I, and just to celebrate with my father's family. He's one of eight children. He's a triplet. His name's Jose. His sister's name was Maria. His brother's name is Jesus. So you have the Holy Family right there. Joseph, Joseph, Mary, and Jesus. As I was preparing to go, this happens almost every time, a well-meaning friend, perhaps you have a well-meaning friend, took me aside and said, you know, it's very dangerous over there. You better be careful, you know, it's violence and drugs and the government is corrupt and you could get malaria if you go. And I smiled and I was polite as I sometimes am in those situations. And I tried to take it and do my best. A week ago today, I'm sitting with family. We're celebrating my tia's birthday, and a well-meaning relative comes over to me. And she says, primo, which means cousin. You know, when you go back to the United States, I want you to make sure that you stay safe over there. You know, they have shootings in malls and in department stores, and they even shoot people in churches over there. And you know, the government is corrupt. And primo, you could get coronavirus when you get back, so make sure you stay safe, primo. Maybe the hot messes are in our corner of the world as well. And our churches don't fare that much better. Perhaps your church is in a hot mess right now. We have denominations splitting or denominations that are in danger of splitting. We have all kinds of cases of clergy misconduct, which in turn harm our witness. If you're a mainliner, perhaps you're struggling with losses of numbers in your denomination. Too many evangelicals sound more like a sycophant of the state instead of a voice crying in the wilderness. So often, it's in our churches in which we're making mountains out of molehills that outsiders look upon us and they don't really want to pay attention to all of that hot mess, do they? They're not paying attention at all, or perhaps they're paying attention for all the wrong reasons. So what do we do when people look through our stained glass windows in order to see our broken glass houses in which we live? What do we do when it feels like the floorboards are shaking beneath our feet in our sanctuaries? What do we do when we're struggling for survival, when it seems like we're in a hot mess? Perhaps it is providential that the questions that we find ourselves asking are, in many ways, the questions that Christians have asked throughout their history. How do we maintain a vibrant witness in the face of hardship? How do we survive when it feels like life is under threat, when it feels like the world is coming apart at the seams? Perhaps it is providence as well that these are the questions that diaspora Christians asked so long ago, as they were struggling with what it looked like to be citizens of this world, even though they were citizens of heaven, sojourners and strangers who were battling for survival. That's what the book of 1 Peter is about, isn't it? A wonderful and sharp New Testament commentator by the name of Shively Smith, who teaches at Boston University, makes this observation. So often 1 Peter has been used historically in order to harm marginalized and oppressed communities in America. Yet to have a more appreciative understanding and a more accurate understanding of 1 Peter would require of us a willingness to recognize that those who were reading this letter were in fact marginalized and persecuted themselves. Here's what Smith writes. 1 Peter is in fact the writing of the slave. It is the writing from the underclass for the underclass, not for the overlord. You see, 1 Peter is a book about what it looks like to survive in the midst of la lucha, in the midst of the struggle, to survive in the midst of hardship. That's not only what the book is about. That's what this passage is about. But what's the secret? What's the secret to maintaining hope in the midst of hardship? What's the secret to endurance in the face of suffering? What's the secret to survival? Well, I'm glad you asked. Now, if we were to look at the first couple of verses, we might conclude that the real secret to survival, to hope in the midst of hardship, is for us to love each other better than we do now. Did you notice there at the beginning of the text, have unity of spirit, which literally is be of one mind, have sympathy, which means to be willing to suffer with one another, love each other. It's the word that we translate as Philadelphia. It means brotherly and sisterly love. I assure you that we would hate each other much less if we started seeing each other as sisters and brothers in God's eyes. Have a tender heart, which means to have compassion. It's the word that was used of the Good Samaritan who comes along beside the person in the ditch. It's the word that's used of Jesus when it says that he was filled with compassion. Have a humble mind. Don't consider yourself better than others. Be sure to lift up the lowly. Be sure not to become a haughty person. If we were to get a hold of this, imagine what could happen. Churches would be in the news for all the right reasons and not the wrong ones. People who wouldn't normally get together would start getting together, wouldn't they? A church would become a place where the lonely and the lost and the outsider and the foreigner would have arms wide open to receive welcome. Churches would become a place where people know and are known instead of being hidden. Oh, it could be a wonderful thing if people started loving each other better than they do now. But I'm not really sure that's the heart of the text or the main thrust of what's going on here, because when it shifts in verse 13, it shifts to talking about how Christians interact with and relate to those outside the fellowship. So maybe that's the secret. Maybe the secret to survival is for us to love those outside the fellowship better than we do now. You don't need me to tell you what's at stake. You don't need me to tell you what happens when Christians push people away from the hope of the gospel rather than having a winsome and courageous and dynamic and vibrant witness. I think of Nietzsche's character in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, who utters these words: to believe in their Redeemer, more redeemed his disciples would have to look to me. Mahatma Gandhi, when he was in South Africa studying, saw how white South African Christians treated black South Africans, and he was mortified. A young Methodist missionary named E. Stanley Jones interviewed him and asked him what it would be like or what would have to happen in order for Christianity to make inroads in India, and Gandhi replied, "I would suggest, first of all, that all of you Christians, missionaries and all, begin to live more like Jesus." We know the number one reason people give for why they remain outside the fellowship, it's Christians. But you know, it could go the other way, right? I have a friend who, for many years, was a social worker in Massachusetts, Boston, Cambridge area. He served refugees from Somalia and Liberia and Ethiopia, most of whom were Muslims. This was after 9/11 and at a time when it was especially difficult to be a Muslim in the United States. And he wasn't in your face about it. He wasn't trying to shove a message down anyone's throats. He was just trying to serve and love and be humble and caring, help people find jobs, help kids get into school. So one time, his friend takes him aside, his friend who is in his 20s, a refugee from a war-torn country, and he says, "You know, I have a question for you." He says, "Sure, go ahead. What's your question?" "Why is it that Christians love Muslims so much?" You know, the reason, the number one reason why so many choose to join the fellowship, right, is Christians. Maybe that's the secret. Maybe the secret is to love those outside the fellowship more than we do now, in addition to loving each other better than we do now. The world would be a much better place if we did both of those things, wouldn't it? But even then, I don't know if that's the true secret to survival. As the text unfolds, we see all kinds of discussions around suffering, the experience of unjust suffering. Now, we have to be careful here because all kinds of bad theologies could develop here. But if we think about it in the context of a marginalized and persecuted and oppressed minority, for that marginalized and oppressed and persecuted minority to know that there was one who went before them, Jesus, that there was one who knows what it's like. In Spanish, we might say, Jesús me acompaña. Jesus accompanies me in the midst of my lament. Do you notice verse 18? For Christ also suffered once for all to bring you to God, the righteous for the unrighteous. Now, I don't know what it means that it says that Jesus preached to the spirits that were in prison. The reformer Martin Luther also said, I have no idea what it means. I'm not quoting, I'm paraphrasing. One of my favorite commentators, or one of my favorite comments by a commentator, he said this, and I'm paraphrasing, of this we can be sure, Jesus went somewhere to preach to certain spirits in some prison at some time. Well, thank you very much. Thank you. How much did I pay for this book again? I don't know about all of the complexities of what's going on here. I think part of what's going on here is this recognition that there is a Jesus who goes before us. Maybe that's the secret to survival. When we look to Jesus' experience of unjust suffering, it will help us to hold up in the midst of unjust suffering. You know, Bonhoeffer's final words to the world were not contained in Life Together, and they were not contained in books like Christ the Center. No, his final words to the world were written on a prison cell. Six words that they discovered in the concentration camp where he remained in prison for so long. And six words were this: only a suffering God can help. That'll preach, won't it? That'll preach to the single parent whose spouse left the family. That'll preach to the person going through another round of chemotherapy in your congregation. That'll preach to any lonely pastor who, whenever that pastor thinks that they're alone, they remember that there was one who suffered alone so that they wouldn't have to suffer alone. That'll preach to know that Jesus accompanies us, that he's Emmanuel, God with us. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Nobody knows the trouble I see. Nobody knows but Jesus. Maybe that's it. Well, no. I think if we were to only stop there, we would only go part of the way with Jesus rather than the whole way with him and the whole way of the passage. And we get little hints of it. We get a hint of it in verse 9 when we learn that we are able to have this inheritance in him. We get another little hint of it in verse 15. There's a hope in us that's bigger than the suffering that takes place against us or around us. And then I think it really gets clearer in verse 21. Baptism, which now saves you, it heals you, it makes you whole. It's not a removal of dirt from the body, but it is an appeal to God for a good conscience. And there it is, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Did you hear it? The song, the bright song in the midst of a dark night? It sounds something like this. In the midst of unjust suffering, someday vindication is coming. Someday, all the wrongs will be made right. Someday, even if you see and experience unjust suffering and seek to eradicate it, because you cannot eradicate it all and I cannot eradicate it all, someday all of it will be eradicated. Or we put it another way, he was put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit. So in the battle to survival, the battle to survive, remember resurrection. Many people in here have heard of that theologian and missiologist, Leslie Newbegin. During his younger years, he was a bishop for the Church of South India in two different cities, first in Madurai and later on in Madras. And from time to time, whether it was a news reporter or someone seeking information, someone would ask him this question: so are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of the church in South India? And this would be his reply: I believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Therefore, the question does not arise. In one of his books, he reminds believers of this abiding truth. The gospel is a news of a fact, he said. So you cannot so much be optimistic or pessimistic about it. The real question is, do you believe it or do you not believe it? You want to know something? For the person, for the community that believes it, and I mean that really believes it, the words of that old gospel song remain true. Trouble don't last always. Amen.